Hello, I'm Mariet Snyman, a journalist devoted to uncovering new ways to live a happier and healthier life. Thanks for tuning in to Calm, Clear and Helpful, my weekly podcast series on taking good care of yourself and others. In this series, I introduce you to wellness professionals ready to inform and inspire. Today's topic is families, how storytelling can clarify shared values and strengthen bonds. If you sometimes wish you could feel closer to your loved ones, experience a greater sense of belonging, or find it easier to process challenges, then I trust today's interview will lift your spirits. My guest is Gail Turner, co-founder and president of the Storytellers Channel and international radio show host from Richmond, Virginia. Welcome on the show, Gail.
I am delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
And I'm honored. I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. And to our listeners, during our conversation, Gail will share his tips on applying the transformative power of storytelling in families, and then it will be fun question time. Gail, I've known you for a while, and you wear many hats in the business world as well as the entertainment industry, but it seems to me that no matter where you operate, you're a storyteller. What would you say to that?
Well, I think that all of us are storytellers, just some of us work at it. The neuroscience has shown that stories are how we make sense of the world. As a matter of fact, that there is research that shows we actually live into the stories we tell ourselves. A lot of people used to think that those stories were what we had done in the past, but it seems that what happens is that we're constantly running a movie in our head, dealing with whatever comes our way, and we are living into that character. I first ran across this concept back in 1980 in a film called Mon Oncle d'Amérique by Alain Resnais. And it was about the work of the French behaviorist Henri Laborie. And it was an absolutely fascinating movie because, first of all, you saw him experimenting with rats. And then you saw human beings in the same situations and they were behaving like the rats. And then he began this whole concept that we were running movies or little clips of our heroes in our head so that we could live into that behavior, we could live up to it. And when I saw that, I thought to myself, oh, my Lord, that is the way I live my life. I have been playing movies of the way I would behave in a situation, or better yet, the way my daddy would behave in a situation. And so when you asked me to talk about the role of story in family, I grew up in a family of storytellers. And every now and then I talk to folks and they tell me that their parents never told me about what it was like growing up, or they never had a chance to talk to their grandparents and hear what their lives were like. And I'm always saddened by that, because the irony is that, well, irony, that's probably the wrong word. We'll describe whatever I'm going to tell you in a second. But the United States has just come out of its longest war in the history of the country. And we have a volunteer armed forces, which meant we kept returning our men and women back into harm's way. And some of them were resilient and others less so. And so the military did a lot of research on this for who were the ones who were able to adapt. And the first thing they discovered was those who had a faith practice or a faith tradition. It didn't really matter what it was, but as long as they had something where there was a story that they told themselves, that there was something larger than them. They saw themselves as part of something bigger than just themselves. That made sense to me. But the second part was just mind-blowing for me. They said the people who knew the story of their birth, the day that they were born, for example, the ones who knew the stories of how their parents met. And I'm thinking, cha-ching, cha-ching, I've got both those down. And then they said there was the my expression, but the whipped cream and the cherry on top of the sundae was those who knew the stories of their grandparents and their ancestors before them. Ching, ching, ching for me again. And so there was this sense that you realized you were part of something bigger than yourself. People had to survive just for you to be here. And let's face it, we're all pretty arrogant to one degree or another. If they can do it, well, I can do it. But it comes back to me regularly about the Henry Ford quote that turned out to be something Confucius said, that those who believe they can and those who believe they can't are both right. Because the person who believes they can, they may fall down, but because they believe they can, they get up again, right? They try again, they try again. But those who believe they can't, the minute they run up against an obstacle, they go, see, I told you we couldn't do this, and they give up. So this takes me back to sharing some, if you don't mind, I'll share some stories from my childhood about my family and how they've impacted my life. Does that fit with what you have in mind, Mariette?
Yes, I must say, Gail, you've mentioned so many things now, and I'm starting to realize that stories are much more powerful in life than I thought. But please go ahead with your stories, the family stories.
We can have an opportunity to talk about those other things another day, okay?
Yeah.
One of the earliest stories that I remember was my mother and her parents were moving from the small town that they had been living in to the big city of Richmond. This is back in the 1940s. And they delayed the move because they received the telegram that my mother's oldest brother had been killed at the invasion of Sicily during World War II. So when they moved to Richmond, it was a sad time in many ways. And my mom went to a little elementary school, and the next year she passes on to what they called junior high. And they walked the children from the elementary school all the way up to the junior high school so they could see where they were going to go the next year so they would know how to get there, right? Well, this was Binford Junior High School, only the seventh junior high school built in the country. And it was the only school in the country, and maybe to this day, where you could go from the basement to the roof without ever going up at a step. They had ramps for going up and steps for coming down. Well, my mother said, there they are, all of the little children. This place is so much bigger than the school they'd been in, and it's almost awe-inspiring. And she said she saw a boy walking down the up incline. He had his sleeves rolled up a couple of times, his hands in his pockets. And here's like a 14-year-old boy with a pipe in his mouth upside down. I'm sorry, it makes me smile. It seems yes. so much of a posturing kind of thing. But here's the part that just caught my attention. She said, he was the most beautiful thing I had ever seen in my life. Well, they get done with the little tour and they go back to the, you know, to their school. And now it's summertime. And she was sitting in church one Sunday over next to the windows. This is long before air conditioning, and the windows are open. And she looked out and she saw that boy was walking by. And he was going to the Methodist church that backed up to the Baptist church where she was going. She changed churches the next Sunday. And as I like to say, my daddy never stood a chance, right? Well, the course of true love never runs smoothly. And so they were going to a party. My mother and her little neighbor, a good friend, were going to a party. And my daddy with some of his buddies were following along. And you know how teenage boys are. They think they're cute and funny. And so they were making cracks. And my mother decided that I don't care how damn pretty he is. He's arrogant and obnoxious, and I want nothing to do with him. So they get to the party. And apparently they're playing spin the bottle. For those of you who don't know about this, you should look up Wikipedia. But I don't know if my mama spun the bottle and it pointed to my daddy or if my daddy spun the bottle and it pointed to my mama. But they got up and they went behind a sheet that was hung over a clothesline with light behind it. And they kissed. And mama said, that's it. I was in love. Who cares? Who cares about what a smart mouth he was out in the street? She says, I was in love. So they're 14 and 15 years old by this time, right? So by the time they're 19, you know, she's been the only girl in my daddy's life. His uncles had told him that he should date other girls. So he told mama that, you know, they should see other people. And the first date my mother had was somebody else. My father apparently stood a block away the whole time watching. I think we call that stalking today. And he went back and they ended that nonsense. So my daddy managed to get her a diamond. And so he wants her to marry him, but he doesn't have a job. And she says, I'm not going to marry you. You don't have a job. And he goes, well, if you don't marry me, I'm going to join the Navy. She says, fine. Well, he goes off to join the Air Force and discovers how far away San Antonio is. So he says, no. But he comes back and he says, if you don't marry me, I'm going to join the Navy. And she says, fine. Well, my dad happened to be a corporal in the Marine Reserves at that time. And he'd been trying to get the Marines to transfer him to the regular Marines, but it hadn't happened. So my dad goes off to boot camp. And while he's in boot camp, his mother gets a letter. He's been promoted to sergeant, transferred to the regular Marines. But the Navy's like, we don't care what they say. You belong to us. And my mother misses him so much while he's in boot camp, she marries him when he comes home. Because let's face it, he's got a job now. Mm. Well, over the next 3.5 years, he travels the world. And all he can think about is he wants to get home. And my mom becomes pregnant with me. And he is scheduled to take leave when I'm on my due date, which was August 25th. And while he's down here, the ship is going to go away for the North Atlantic cruise. And so he will be able to spend his last 6 months in Richmond in the Navy, living at home. And man, he's got it all planned out. And what's the old adage? If you want to see God laugh, sure, your plan. I come 2 weeks early. So he had been thumbing back and forth from Providence, Rhode Island, 3 weekends a month of the year that my mom was expecting me. And so he manages to get a plane down to Baltimore, thumbs into Richmond. He sees that I'm there, goes home, gets a night's sleep, comes back the next day. And they're talking about that I've got this full head of hair down at my shoulders. And he told me, he said, all I knew is they showed me you were in behind that glass window. They told me you had 10 fingers and 10 toes, and I went home. So he went back down to look at me, and he has to go back. So for the next 6 months, my father's at sea. And when he comes home, they said that the first time he spoke, because my dad had a deeper voice than I do, the first time he spoke, I broke into tears. By the next morning, we were inseparable. My father could set me down and I would go to anybody. But if you tried to take me from my father, I just threw into a fit. And this was the beginning of 38 years of an inseparable relationship. I adored my dad. And anything he did, I wanted to be like him. There's some upsides to that and some downsides. He was a smoker. I started smoking when I was 10 because I wanted to be like my daddy. Goodness. But that year of 10 was a big year. Okay. By the way, let's face it. If you don't think children aren't watching you, you can say all you want, but they watch you, right? Mm. So my dad had become a bricklayer after he got out of the Navy. And by the time I'm 10, he's a contractor. And I wanted to go to work with my daddy because when he and my uncles and my cousins would talk about it, it just sounded like they had such a great time. And so finally the day came. It's a Saturday morning. We got up before sunrise. We went to the White Tower, which was a precursor of McDonald's. We had scrambled eggs and French fries, and it was still dark outside. And so in the plate glass windows that were lit inside, you could actually see the reflections of these working men sitting around the table. And there I was, 10 years old and probably not even 4 foot. Just, I'm one of them. I was elated. So we get to the job site and my dad says, look, here's what you have to do. You have to carry brick from this pile over to the wall where the men are working. And you can sit down whenever you want, as long as the men have brick. Well, I'm obviously not the only one doing this. There are men on the job. And I'll be candid. I always thought my daddy was making a man out of me. And then I became a parent myself later on and realized this was just daycare of the 60s, right? Mm. But by lunchtime, let me tell you, if I'd never seen a job site for the rest of my life, I'd have been happy. I was exhausted. And I asked, when are we going home? And it was like a Greek chorus. All of the men, like in one voice, went, when the job is done. This became the story of my life, quite frankly. It's a story I tell regularly to the folks who work with me, but we go home when the job is done. So there's another thing happened this year when I was 10. I heard my parents talking about the boy who delivered the evening papers wasn't getting the job done. Now, my daddy had delivered papers when he was a boy because amongst other things, his father died when he was 13, and he, as the oldest son, dropped out of school by the time he was 15, and he was taking care of his mother, his big sister, and his little brother. And so he never told me these stories as a boasting, posturing thing. These were just the facts of life of his childhood. And my mom used to talk about how my dad would scrub the floors of the house before he went out on a date with her. Or he would, when he did get a job, he would bring all of his money home and give it to his mother. And so my dad was, I heard these stories about the behavior that was just expected of a son, right? So I overheard them talking about this boy not delivering the papers. And so I went out and I saw him and I said, "You don't like doing this, do you?" And he said, "No." I said, "Well, how much do you want for the route?" He said, $1. I was only being paid $1 to carry brick all day long. And I don't think I was earning that dollar then. But I said, "Look, I'll see you tomorrow." In those days, they used to have a 2-cent deposit on soft drink bottles. And so I literally walked the neighborhood, the alleys and the street corners, because people left these things all over the place. And by the next day, I had collected 50 bottles, took them to the grocery store. I got my buck and I bought my first business. Well, I got a ratty old canvas paper bag that looked like it was left over from World War II. I got the list of the people who took the papers, and it was on the old 3-hole paper that we had in our notebooks at school, and it had been written in paper and erased, and there were holes, and it was falling apart because it had been folded and opened so many times. But I got his collection book, and it turns out he was any better at collecting money than he was delivering papers. There were $12 worth of uncollected receipts. I was wealthy. Well, I only collected $8 of those receipts, which taught me another lesson that the longer you wait to collect a debt, the longer it's going to take to get it. But from then until I got my driver's license at 16, I delivered papers morning and night. And I remember the first day I went to get the papers, they asked, "Where's Johnny?" And I said, "He asked me to get the papers." The next day, "Where's Johnny?" "He asked me to get the papers." And nobody asked after that because nobody was complaining that the papers weren't being delivered. And on that first Saturday that I went and paid the bill for my papers, they asked, "Where's Johnny?" And I said, "He asked me to pay the bill." And they never asked again where Johnny was because nobody was complaining about the papers not being delivered and the bills were being paid on time. 2 years later, when I was old enough to actually get a route, because you see, you had to be 12 to have a route, supposedly. I went and filled out the paperwork and moved to another route. And from there on out, as I say, I delivered many a paper. It taught me a lot, but first and foremost, there was my dad and his men's stories echoing in my head. We go home when the job is done, because I had heard stories over and over that the men would share about somebody got hurt on a job. Well, that's fine. You took him to the hospital, whatever, but you came back and you did the work. The day that my 7th birthday, when my dad and my uncle, they had found a bike literally on the junkyard and had sanded it, painted it, and built me a bike from component parts. But they'd had to go to work that morning, and they were late getting to the picnic. And when they showed up, it turned out that on the way to the job, they'd had a flat tire. They'd literally had to unload all the brick off of the truck to lighten the weight, jack the truck up, change the tire, put the stuff back on, go do the job, and then still show up for my party. Now, I didn't hear about that until later because my dad, all I had eyes for was that pretty purple bike that came off the truck that day. But my mom told me that story. Between my mom and my dad telling me the stories of their childhoods and how they met and their marriage, and later learning the stories about my grandparents, I have a story of myself that I am somebody who can do things. My mom's position was I could do anything I put my mind to. My dad was more like, "You're going to fall over time, but you know, you're only a loser if you quit when you're down. So get up, try it again, try again." In terms of the business of we don't go home until the job is done. That's just part of the story that to me is about being an adult, right? And so in later years, both of my grandmothers fell into poor health. And my parents rented the apartment next door to them. At the time, my wife and I happened to be living in the apartment to the west of them in another building. And so there were my grandmothers, my parents, and my wife and I, and soon our daughter, all living bum, bum, bum next to each other. And my parents looked after my grandmothers until they died. Well, years later, as a matter of fact, the room I'm sitting in is an addition I built on my house for my mother to come live with us when her dementia reached the point when she could not, she couldn't take care of herself anymore. And so for her last 7 months, she lived with us and I was her primary caregiver. And a lot of people have talked to me about, oh, what a noble thing this was, how exceptional this was. And I've never seen it that way. This was just what the people in my family do. They take care of their family. They talk about us being a sandwich generation these days. Mm. And I'll tell you, there was more than once that I needed my father's help, and he stepped up when I was younger, particularly when I was a young entrepreneur. And it seemed I'd seen that behavior modeled. I'd heard the stories of the family and how they had handled things. And so I say to you that story alone is worthless. Okay. I mean, it's used. I will say this. Don't tell stories about what not to do because the brain doesn't understand. No, you say don't touch the stove. And what's the next thing you hear? Ow. But the idea that you behave in a certain way and you reinforce that behavior with stories that exemplify the behavior, not with, well, when I was a boy, you know, we walked to school uphill both ways in the snow barefoot. It's not that kind of stories. It's just sharing what life has been, right? And you find that people say to me, why kids don't want to listen? Well, let me show you, tell you something. I grew up at the beginning of television, so I've been a TV addict since I was born. Comic books, the newspaper. I mean, there's always something to distract. And yet, the first step in being able to have the right to tell your children's stories is to listen to theirs, to ask them, what happened today? Nothing. Really? From the minute you left the house this morning, nothing surprised you. You didn't learn anything new. What about your friends? Anybody do anything interesting today? What did you see? Open-ended questions. It's something that just prompts it. And if people discover you're really interested in listening, like what's going on right now, you feel like, oh, my God, I dropped a Victrola needle and he's never going to stop. But people will share their stories, because if you watch your children, they're telling stories with their friends. You think about yourself. We call it gossip with women, which is such a misogynistic piece of business. But we all share the stories about what's going on. Who did so-and-so? Who did what? And we all behave like we're the center of the world. It happened to us, only us, whatever the case may be. But one of the kindest things you do for somebody is to listen. And so when you want somebody to listen to you, it generally starts with what my mama used to say, if you want a friend, you have to be a friend. And one of the signals of friendship for me, and it's a signal of family, is that we listen. And so look for opportunities to find out what happened. Because, you know, a story is a sequence of events, meaning something happened in which something changes. A lot of the news reports that I hear, they're just reports. They're not really a story, although they use that language all the time. But if you're listening to this right now, and you're what story are you telling yourself as you listen to this old man who's just been running his mouth for, 25 mm-hmm. minutes? You have overcome things in your life. It's not about bragging that I overcame them. What your children want to hear about is not that you won or you lost, but that you challenged, that you struggled, that you engaged. I was only 4'11" when I entered high school, and my name is Gail. So you can imagine I got a lot of grief during my elementary years. And they didn't teach nonviolent conflict resolution when I was a child, okay? The old John Wayne school of you don't start fights, but you finish them. And by the way, I got beat up all the time. But my father used to say to me that, look, you can't run. You just can't run because they will hound you. So you have to stand your ground. But you have to make the leader of that group realize they will suffer if you suffer. And after a while, they'll leave you alone, right? I've come to realize that I probably provoked every damn time I got into some sort of a scrap. Because I was little, my name was Gail, and it was my daddy's name. And anytime they gave me grief about my name, that's my daddy's name, right? And so I'm defending a daddy who didn't need to be defended. But I'm sure that my mouth got me into almost every problem I ever had because I wouldn't let it go. I just was like a dog with a bone. So when I talk to my daughters, I have a 41 and a 53-year-old. I talk to them regularly about, you know, there are some things that your daddy did when he was growing up that really are not the things you want to model. How would you handle these things differently? Both of my daughters are strong women who are both leaders, quite frankly. One runs an advertising agency, and the other trains horses to the saddle and teaches people how to ride. And they are extraordinary human beings. Well, I could talk about them for days. But the thing that I most admire about both of them is that they generally find a way to de-escalate a situation as opposed to escalating it. And I didn't discover that till I went through anger management counseling at 55, right? So the joys of being able to not just teach your children, but learn from your children, well, that only happens when you're listening to them, right? So finding opportunities, the best opportunities that I had, quite frankly, was I used to ride around the front seat of the pickup truck with my daddy. Because if he would leave a job site, particularly when I was little, he would take me with him and he would explain to me why he had done a certain thing on the job site. When he would go visit clients, I'm telling you, at 10 years old, I remember walking into a CEO's office with my father. And I had been expected to walk up, shake the man's hand, look him in the face, you know, say, nice to meet you, sir, and then step back, shut up and listen, right? My father didn't say shut up. He said be quiet, but the message was shut up. And I got to watch leadership exercised. I got to watch my dad. And I'll be candid, I didn't really understand what I was watching for years. Because it always seemed to me that when my father told somebody to do something, they did it. And so I thought that leadership was about telling people what to do. And yes, there is an element of clarity in being a leader. You know, this is what we need to accomplish. This is what I expect. But what I've come to realize over time, that there are two significant elements of leadership that were present, but I just didn't recognize them. First was respect. My father treated everybody with respect. It didn't matter if it was the laborer carrying brick or it was the bank president that he was, you know, doing the job for. He always left a man an out. He never backed people into a corner. He was clear about what he wanted. He was clear about when performance wasn't up to his standards, he was clear. But he never demeaned people. I have to be candid. It took me a while to realize that, you know, dressing somebody down really wasn't going to get me the result I wanted. He would share stories of behavior that it took me years to realize what he'd been trying to tell me at the time. But I'm deeply thankful that I have this reservoir of stories to draw on. But many of those stories were just the two of us driving around in a pickup truck, and I got to hear those. The second was he didn't like pretension. I have chosen to use the word humility, which Richard Foster defines as living as close to the truth as possible. My dad didn't like pretentious people. He used to have the expression that person was playing a role. And this, just being straight with people, being present. And by the way, these are my two primary values by which I evaluate my behavior as well. And I know where I got them from. It took me a while to recognize what was going on there. But when you think about your childhood, if you were blessed enough to have your parents there, if you were blessed enough to have grandparents, or if you were like Odysseus' son Telemachus and you had mentor, somebody there to help you grow up, look back and think about the positive lessons that you've learned from the struggles in your life. Was it that you persevered? Sometimes it's discretion is the better part of valor. Was it that sometimes you just stepped away because this wasn't going to be a good choice? Sharing with your children, sharing with your spouse, sharing with your buddies, which, you know, guys do all the time. This was the struggle, and this is how we dealt with it. This is how we overcame it. We don't tend to tell stories very often about when we failed, but I will say this, when a person fails but then gets up again, we're talking about resilience, right? It's generally because they've got some story in their head that they can, and all of us want to instill that in our children so that they will be able to, right? I hired George Lakoff years ago, a professor out of Berkeley, who wrote a book, Don't Think of an Elephant. And he talked about the frames through which we look at life. And frames are another form of storytelling, right? And he said that first, there's the strict father, the frame, which is, look, my responsibility is to equip you to go out and survive in this world. It's a hostile place and you need to be able to deal with it. So shut up and do whatever I tell you. When you're 18, you're on your own and you make your own decisions. The other is what they call the nurturing parent, who sees the world as a lovely place and everybody should have an opportunity to do whatever, to take advantage of this largesse. Well, my wife was obviously raised, my second wife, forgive me, was obviously raised in a strict father family. And when I would ask my daughter and her daughter from her previous marriage, when I would ask them, what would you like to do? It used to drive her crazy because she wasn't used to children having a say in anything. And I used to say, if we can't give them an opportunity to make decisions and see the consequences of their choices, well, how do we think that's going to happen when they're out on their own, right? So here I am all these years later working with corporations. I work with leaders. I primarily these days work with privately owned companies with, you know, I don't know, 30 to 500 employees. And the issue is frequently building their leadership bench within the organization. How do we help them develop the leadership capacity of their people? Well, you know, leaders only do three things. We initiate and sustain change, and we grow other leaders. And when it comes to growing leaders, well, first of all, let's face it, a lot's been written about change. I'm a big fan of John Kotter, K-O-T-T-E-R's work. But there's not a lot written about growing leaders. But there are some things that I think are critical. And first and foremost is instilling values. Values are the criteria we use for making decisions. In my case, I've already told you, the first two are respect and the second is humility. The second thing, though, is you need to teach them how to make decisions. And people only learn from their decisions when they get a chance to be the one that makes decisions and see what the consequences are. Over time, you know, if you ask me, I think one of the biggest dreads of most business owners is that their employees are going to do something when they're not there and it's going to destroy the ship. And so over time, being able to give people the opportunity to build those muscles for making decisions. Well, what's an easy way to do that? Well, back to being clear about values. And how do you instill values? You tell the stories. Because neuroscience has shown that story is the most effective way to embed a model of behavior in a human brain. So whether you're a parent, whether you're looking at your immediate family, your extended family, we're constantly, every time we open our mouths, trying to influence somebody, right? And so what do you want them to do? I either want them to do something differently, I want them to continue doing something, or I want them to adopt a mode of behavior, i.e. a value that I see value in. So I know I've been rattling for a while here, Mariette. Have I touched on the things that you wanted me to, or is there anything else you'd like me to? Well, I tell you, and I'm going to stop for a second. I do have something else I want to share.
Right.
All right, so here I am. You know, I'm told you stay until the job's done. So 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, I get more responsibility. By the time I'm 16, my dad's made me a foreman. And what that means is I'm responsible for getting men and material to the job, doing the drawings, and getting permits for jobs. And I want to be left in charge. I do. I want to be the boss. Okay, well, I'm 21 before he leaves me in charge of a job. And right before he left, he said, look, pay attention to your uncles, because my dad's brother and my mother's brother both worked for him. And he said, listen to them, because they'll do exactly what you tell them to do, knowing it's wrong, so they can tell me you told them to do it. Okay, so make sure that you listen to what they have to say. Well, he wasn't gone that long when something came up and I didn't know what to do. There were a lot of options. I couldn't choose one. I asked my uncles, I couldn't choose one. And so the job site ground to a halt. When my dad showed back up and men were standing around, I mean, he was pretty calm because I knew he was upset. Anyway, he asks the question, what's going on? We tell him he's got him back to work in a moment. He takes me aside. He says, what happened? So I explained the situation, and I don't remember what it was quite candidly, but I know I gave him options. And he said, any one of those would have been fine. He says, you have to remember that I can fix wrong. I can't fix nothing. You need to do something when you're responsible, okay? And then he looked at me and he said, I trust you. You need to trust yourself. Well, it's 7 years later. I'm 28 years old and I am running a job site. And I must have lost my attention because all of a sudden I have damaged my left hand seriously. And after the screaming's over, I get the men back to work. I go to a local pharmacy. I clean it up, bandage it up, and come back. And for the rest of the day, as we finish this job, every time the hammer hits, I'm not sure if it's the pain from the blood pounding through my hand or the just the noise. But we get done. I collect the check and I go home. And as I mentioned, we live next door to my parents. And so I drop the check off to my dad. This was a Wednesday. And my mother sees my hand and goes, "What happened?" And I explain, "Why didn't you come home?" And I said, "Well, Mom, quite frankly, if I hadn't been a foreman, I would have. But I was responsible for that job being completed because if we hadn't done it today, we wouldn't got the check. Daddy couldn't deposit the check tomorrow, and we wouldn't be able to make payroll on Friday." Well, my dad just nodded because, first of all, he hadn't asked about my hand because he'd seen me bleed more times on a job site than you can shake a stick at. But that was what was expected of me. So as I walked next door and walked up the steps that night, it dawned on me I had become one of the men who gets the job done. I tell this story not because, aren't I a tough son of a gun? I tell this story because that behavior was modeled for me from the time I was 10 years old over and over again. I saw men in pain. I saw men tired. I saw men aching that stayed until they got the job done. This character trait, for lack of a better word, is something that was instilled in me. I wasn't born with a work ethic. None of us are. So when we want people to adopt our values, to do what we want them to do, to accept our influence, well, first of all, it takes repetition. It was 18 years between, by the way, I'd have said I was one of the guys who got the job done prior to that. But let me tell you something. I knew it that night, right? And so when we are looking to influence people, behavior, walking the talk is incredibly important. But story is the piece that will stay in their head. Because, you know, I saw my father do a whole lot of things that I now actually understand why and try to mimic that material behavior myself. But it's the stories that stick with me. There was one night they were working overnight in some plant and my uncle fell through a roof and my father literally had to break into the building to get to my uncle. They got him to the hospital and then they came back and worked all night long and finished that job. That story sticks with me to this day because my dad used to say that he needed these men so that he could, you know, run his business. And so he had to take care of those men. He used to say the first thing they teach officers in the Navy is to take care of your men. So these stories that I've heard over time, they run through my head regularly when I'm faced with a situation. It's almost like it's like you're seeing a card file go, "Oh yeah, that one. That does that work? No, maybe that one." So ask yourself, for those of you who've been kind enough to stay this long listening to me, because by the way, I think one of the nicest things anybody can do for anybody is to listen to them. So for those of you who stayed on, ask yourself, what are the stories that exemplify the kind of behavior that's the kind of person you'd like yourself to be? What are the stories that you tell yourselves when you're faced with adversity? What are the stories that I hope you share with your friends? Because once again, remember, it's not the winning or the losing. It's that you engaged in the struggle. That's what we do, people. We engage in the struggle. I happen to believe we're here to serve. Okay, that's how I think my value in this world is that I am here to serve. When I look for ways of how I do that, when I look for ways of what's the appropriate behavior in, you know, XYZ situation, I've come to understand that what I'm doing is drawing on the catalog of stories that I have. I read 90 books last year, probably 2/3 fiction and 1/3 nonfiction. And I'll be candid, I'm always kind of feeling guilty when I'm reading fiction because I always think I've got work to do. But my wife was chatting the other day and she said, "Baby, it's just another form of work. You're building up a reservoir of stories. You're building up an understanding of how human nature deals with its struggles. Every day, what do the SEALs say? The only easy day was yesterday. I come to work every day joyful. It's my mission in life to enjoy life and to enthuse others to find joy in theirs. And I have found joy in digging ditches just as much as I found joy, you know, the song and dance man, you know, in the theater. Making a contribution, knowing that you are part of something that is doing something for the betterment of, you know, of others, is another story that I tell myself regularly. I got that from church, obviously. Well, not even that, obviously, but that's, I got that, I'm sure, from church. But it's a constant process for all of us. What story are you telling yourself? And a lot of times when I see people doing behavior that I think is rather egregious, my first thought is, I wonder what story that person is telling themselves that that behavior is acceptable. So when your children do something that you feel like is off the beam, or anybody you know for that matter, you know, the first question back, you know, Covey says, seek first to understand before you seek to be understood. Ask, what were you thinking? I said, walk me through. When did you get to the point that this was the right action? Did you think of any alternatives? Let's think about what you might do differently next time, right? Because when we, let's face it, when we yell at people, all they hear is the tone. They don't really hear the message. And so this business of engaging everybody in our life to understand their stories will, well, strengthen the relationships, and maybe you'll have the opportunity to influence them to behave the way you feel is appropriate. But I'll tell you, every now and then I go into a conversation thinking the other person screwed up and realize I didn't understand the whole situation. And so, you know, back to using, you got one mouth, two eyes, and two ears, use them proportionally, right? So all, look at all these cliches I'm throwing out. I'm just a veritable bag of an old man who's a hot bag of air. So what, Mariette, what else would you like to chat about, darling?
Sure. Gail, I've learned so much from what you've said. And what came to me is that, you know, a story doesn't need to be, as I often think, something really entertaining and original that one's strung together. But from what you say, it seems to me it really is the day-to-day sharing of one's thoughts, I would say, coupled with self-reflection. But what I got from what you've been saying, you used the word engaged a couple of times, and I think stories require connection. That is something that I've just realized.
I think stories create connection, Mariette. Ah. I think they are the currency of humanity. You share a story with somebody, whether you and I are sitting in on the couch watching TV, we're in the movie theater, we're at the theater, we're on a park bench, you know, watching what's going on in front of us. We all try to turn it into some sort of narrative. What is that person's motivation? What are they doing? Why are they doing that? What are they going to do next? Hell, I look at squirrels sometimes, and I'm wondering, raw squirrel, what's a big old nut you got in your mouth? What are you going to do with that thing? You know, people think I'm crazy sometimes, but these stories, they lead to connection. They give us understanding of one another, but even more importantly, Aristotle said the unexamined life is not worth living. Right? When you think about the stories you're telling yourself. Psychiatrists, psychologists, counselors, whatever, use an expression they call old tapes, that you're playing a story in your head, but it's no longer a valid story, right? And so looking for opportunities to what is the story I'm living into, and to be conscious and intentional about it. That's what, by the way, my practice, we talk about the role of intentional story. We tell stories for a reason. And so you may not be conscious of what that reason is. So that's one of the things I try to encourage people to do when you're in a leadership position in particular. Do you know why you're choosing to tell this story? And when I run my storytelling workshops, which are, sometimes it's with an organization, sometimes it's just collections of individuals who I call them Stories Matter workshops. And the idea being that if you have a story that matters to you, that you want to tell to the people who matter to you, I'll help you tell it well enough. They'll ask you to tell it again. Right. And so you begin with, I say, look, just vomit. Give me whatever you got, because people are always, they want to begin, well, you know, this isn't complete yet. It's not ready. And I'm like, I know that, darling. That's why we're here. Okay. So let's get past that and just give me what you've got. And then we'll begin the process of molding it. Okay. We'll begin the process of crafting into its shape. And I tell everybody who comes, because I give them a little PowerPoint that explains the process, that once you vomited, I'm going to ask you, why are you telling me this story? And I'll tell you that a good 50% of the people, even though they know I'm going to ask this question, I get that the look of a deer in headlights, right? Well, they can't answer. And unlike school, where let's face it, we make up BS all the time trying to, you know, con the teacher that we did our homework. I said, look, part of this process here is you're discovering it. Your intuition within you, that somewhere in the back of the animal part of your brain, this story matters. Now, you may not be able to tell me why yet, but if we work on it, if you work on it, you'll be able to discern that, right? And that's what your imagination is, right? You keep working through, well, what are the options? What could this mean, right? And there's your emotions. What does this make me feel, okay? And last of all, there's your common sense. Which of these is applicable or could work? Those four things, Angus Fletcher, wrote a book called Primal Intelligence that just came out recently, where he talks about the role of story in, as our, well, I've defined it as the operating system for warmware. But he talks about one of the reasons we shouldn't be afraid of AI is AI does not have intuition, does not have imagination, does not have emotion, it does not have common sense. And so while it's good at predicting probability, it's not good at coming up with possibility. So just paying attention to the tool, we can find a story that lets us live with it. So once again, if nothing else, make time to sit and listen. If your children like pizza, fine. Let's just sit down together. Tell me about your day. And be really interested, right? I used to laugh that when they say nothing happened, and there was no surprise. And I said, well, here's a surprise. No story, no dessert. Well, that was only a surprise once, right? So, but I'm here today to encourage you to open your heart. Open your heart and open your ears. Sit and be present with people. My mama used to ask, because my dad passed away 29 years before my mom did. And she used to ask, why did the Lord take your father, who made such a contribution to this world, and leave me? And I didn't know how to answer the question. In the last 6 months of my mother's life, as my being her primary caregiver, I finally learned the meaning of the word compassion. Okay. I'd actually seen my parents exhibit it to their mothers when they cared for them. But, you know, all I really saw was the effort, the actions, right? You vacuumed, you cooked, you cleaned. I never really recognized the value of when you just sit with someone as they suffer and you can't do anything about it. That's the actual definition of compassion, is to suffer with. And as I sat there with my mom, and I'll tell you the stories, as I mentioned at the beginning, I see myself as somebody who can. And there wasn't a damn thing I could do for my mama other than just sit there and be with her, hold her, smile at her. I remember once looking at her and thinking that the way she's talking, she doesn't know who I am. And I said, do you know who I am? She said, I know you're the honcho around here. And I got a good laugh out of that. Mm-hmm. And then I saw her eyes flicker. And maybe it was my laugh. I don't know what. But she came back and realized, you know, I was her son. My wife eventually made me get a caregiver coming at night because I had begun to hallucinate from sleep deprivation. And she said, you are telling yourself a story that you have to be the only one that does this. And my wife had lived through her mom having dementia. And so she had wisdom to offer me that I didn't have. Once again, just look at yourself and ask, what stories am I living into? Which stories matter to me that I want to share with my children? And let's face it, I've been talking for what, close to an hour, and brevity is the soul of wit, people. So when you can find the little chunks and you can tell them as short stories. But when you said a moment ago that a story, you think of it as being entertaining, I try to be entertaining, Marietta, and I'm not trying to bore people. But the tickets that I get for their attention are paid for with the attention that I gave them. I never interrupt. I had a mentor years ago who said, you don't learn anything when you're talking. And if somebody wants to interrupt you, let them. Consequently, people know I will let them speak. I'm never going to shut them down. And if they don't want to listen to me, then I don't talk to them. Yeah, I raise my hand in board meetings. They go, you don't have to raise your hand. You know, or people will say, Gail's been down there waiting. I wait until I'm called on, because if I don't have their attention, they're not going to get my message anyway. So you think, well, my children would never listen to me. And I'm like, I see children in the store sometimes going, mama, 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 mama. And the adults ignoring them. My God, if I'd done that, my mama would have killed me. But basically, when I would go up to my mom and she was talking to somebody else, even as a little thing, all it took was mama. And she would look at me and she'd say, just wait a minute, I'm talking to this lady. She would acknowledge me. And then I knew I was going to, I'd been seen, I'd been heard, and I knew I was going to be engaged with in a moment. Now, granted, I was an only, okay, and I know my wife was one of six, and they talk about how the dynamics of who's got enough time for all of this. But the values of how we run our life, when you watch children misbehave in public, they're not misbehaving. They're just behaving the same way they do at home. Because nobody has, for whatever reason, decided that these behaviors were necessary. And I never get upset with the child. I just look at the parents and think, you need help, son, whatever the case may be. The roles for all of us are, first of all, and by the way, if you come to storytellerschannel.com, there's a little tab that says Culture Compass. It's free. It's a little exercise that lets you figure out what your own values are. Because, you know, most of us say we value a whole bunch of things, but we order those values. As I mentioned earlier, respect and humility are my first two. I only have a third one. It's being worthy of trust. It's the, and people say, you mean trustworthy? I said, no, I want the emphasis to be on my behaviors worthy of your trust. So if you came to Storytellers, by the way, we don't collect the information. You can simply download the app, go through the process, and you come up with a little list that lets you go, okay, at the moment, this is how my values are prioritized. Well, have a conversation with your children about that. What do those things mean to them? Have a conversation with your spouse about this. What does this mean? And if you want to have a conversation with your executive team, call me. I'll be happy to lead that. But the idea being, if we're not conscious about these things, then the stories are running our life. And I want a little more control over my life than that. And I do find myself every now and then behaving in a manner that's an old story. It's a story that's not necessarily relevant anymore or applicable to this moment. But we all have a gift. It's what sets us apart. We can envision the possible. We can have a different life. We can picture it and create it and live into it. Maybe it's incremental. It's rare that there's a big epiphany. The engine of this in the end is story. And what a lovely thing this is that we have an opportunity to listen to each other's stories, because I'm a story junkie. So I love listening, quite frankly. I'll be leaving here Tuesday for the National Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro, Tennessee. And I'll be down there for 5 days, three of which Marie and I will be leading a tent. So we're the host for the guests who come. So anywhere from 750 to 1500 of our closest friends that we never knew until they sat down next to us, and you could hear a pin drop while the storytellers tell. I encourage you to look for places in your community where storytelling is promoted. You will have a good evening. You will. And until then, sit down and tell your friends your stories. Listen to their stories. And worst case scenario, grab a book. But either way, stories enrich our lives. I'm going to leave it there, Marietta, unless there's something else that you'd like to dig a little deeper on.
Thank you, Gail. This was something that many things you said I hadn't expected. And other connections I knew you would make, like storytelling, connecting with values. But this has been such, I would say an epiphany for me, because I think you have shown that stories touch absolutely every aspect of our lives and our relationships, including our relationship with ourselves. So thank you very much.
My response to that is amen.
But before you go, Gail, would you just repeat the address of your website? I'll also attach the link to the podcast. And I would also like you to talk about the podcast you co-host.
Yes, ma'am. Okay, first of all, the URL is storytellers, plural, channel.com. It's all one word. The little button is Culture Compass that will let you take the assessment of your values. The radio show is called Stories Matter, Helping Leaders Transform Lives. And my co-host, Shelley Yost Brady, and I, sometimes we're just interviewing each other. Other times we have interviewed leaders from all over the world. And what I'm generally interested in uncovering is just what are the stories of your life? What are the stories? What are the challenges? What are the things you overcome? What are the things that have daunted you, whatever the case may be? And how have you used that as a leader? Back to, as you've heard me say earlier, leaders only do three things. We initiate change, we sustain change, and we grow other leaders. And the process of growing leaders is instilling values in them and helping them learn how to make decisions. These are pretty straightforward things. They're not easy by any means of the imagination. And I'm 73 years old and I'm still learning every day. I'm a lifelong learner and I've had to retool myself at least five times in my life. And so when I hear people say, oh, I'm too old to do whatever, well, then you're telling yourself a story that that's the case. Because this body's been rode hard and put away wet, but I still manage to get up every day and make an effort. There we go. That's it. I'm starting to lecture there. I apologize.
Thank you, Gail. May I ask you a fun question?
Yes, ma'am.
When I say the word dancing, what comes up?
Joy. Lord, I love, I was a professional song and dance man. I did my first show when I was 4, my first professional show at 15 and up until 38. And then I came back at 60 and have done a half dozen shows. I actually got called yesterday day about playing a lead in a musical called Lazarus. And I loved to dance. But boy, I've damaged both arches, torn both Achilles tendons. Both knees have been redone. I got 5 discs in my back. And when Marie and I got married, we had one dance and we were so happy. We were so enjoying ourselves. And we both looked at each other and went, that's enough. My body is just, I've been doing some exercises lately, hoping that before I die, I can get back to dancing with just complete abandon. It's one of the joys of my life. And people used to say, well, you just like being the center of attention. I said, no, I just love to sing and dance. And I enjoy that others enjoy my enjoyment of it. Right. So, I used to sit on the couch when I was a boy and watch my mom and daddy dance in the living room. They were magic. They looked like they flew. That's one of my earliest memories of my folks together, watching them dance. And it conveyed not only their joy and their love, but there was this sense that my mother was protected by him. It was, you had one word, dance, joy.
Thank you, Gail. And I think we can end on that note. Dance, joy, and then stories are part of that. So thank you very, very much.
I look forward to the next time we see each other. Ciao now.
And to our listeners, it was good of you to join us. If you found this conversation meaningful, please share this episode with someone you care about. Go to my website, www.marietsneeman.co.za, for this episode's podcast notes and for free podcasts and articles on how to live a happier and healthier life and have more fulfilling relationships. To follow me on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn, Just search for Mariëtte Snyman Journalist. The podcast series, Calm, Clear and Helpful, is produced by me with original music by Mark Marie Snyman. Catch you next Tuesday at 9.